Happy Stampede indeed. Let's head down to, I imagine, the Los Angeles area. Our boy JD, Jonathan Davis. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. And you?
I'm surviving. It's day six of Stampede, and I missed the first, I want to say, four. And yet, here I am, trying to survive.
You know, really, come on, dude.
Have you partaken in said Stampede before?
I was three the last time I partaked in Stampede.
That doesn't count. No. If you're in one of those little baby backpacks, that's not stampeding. No tents and hangovers when you're three is my guess. Great catching up. Haven't chatted with you since pre-free agency, and we have seen a ton of movement, transactions, and I don't know that there's been a busier GM in the Pacific Division, at least with external work, not just getting his own players done, than Jim Benning. We talked about the JT Miller move. You liked that one. He did sign Tyler Myers on July 1st. To $30 million deal that lasts 5 years. Jordy Benn into the fold. Oscar Fantenberg, a smaller move, but a guy that you'd be familiar with from L.A. and Flames fans would remember from his acquisition at the deadline this past season. And then today, he adds Michael Ferland to the list of offseason work. $14 million over 4 years. A full no move for 2 years. The 27-year-old power forward Michael Ferland, the newest Vancouver Canuck. Your thoughts on the offseason that lame duck Jim Benning has had?
Well, I think he's done some overpaying, to be honest with you, Ryan. I mean, you know, when you look at the Tyler Myers deal and, you know, $6 million a year, I understand maybe, you know, that's the going rate, but is that the guy you really want to be spending $6 million for? I mean, this is a guy that was really more of a third-pairing defenseman. And I'm not, you know, it may make this team slightly better, but I just think that he's going to be exposed in Vancouver. And in the Michael Ferland case, you know, buyer beware on Michael Ferland. You know, you guys know firsthand what Michael Ferland's all about. I mean, yes, he can play up and down your lineup, but this is a guy the last 2 years that, when the calendar flips, you know, Michael Ferland kind of disappears. You know, it was what, I think it was one goal or no goals in his last 17 games to end last season and one in his last 27, and very similar numbers the year before in Calgary. I know St. Louis is kicking the tires on Michael Ferland, and I believe that, you know, the fourth year that Vancouver offered was definitely a deciding factor, from my understanding. So, you know, I just think that, while these signings, you know, may get Canucks fans a little more excited about the season, I just don't think that at the end of the day, you know, these are guys that you really want to have to invest in. I just don't think they're great signings. By any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, here's the thing about Ferland. Like, he absolutely can play up and down your lineup, but where you play him is directly correlated to the player you get. You put him with good players, he looks really good. He was, with Aho at the start of the year in Carolina, put up some great numbers. When he was with Monahan and Gaudreau, he put up some good numbers. But if you play him down the lineup, he doesn't really help a third line in the sense that it's not like guys pop around him. He needs to be around skill to pop. It's an interesting conundrum that way.
It is. And like I said, I just think that this is, you know, he just disappears for too many stretches during the course of the season. And that's the one concern that I would have. But, you know, hey, look, for Michael Ferland to get a 4-year deal and to get those first two with a no move, look, good on him and good on his agent. And obviously, you know, the St. Louis Blues, who I mentioned, we're definitely in the mix. And that's part of the reason, you know, why Pat Maroon is still unsigned by the Blues. And we'll see what happens now that Ferland is, you know, no longer an option for them. But, you know, there's definitely some caution for me when I look at the moves that he has made, being Jim Benning.
Yeah, I'm doing the math here, and it's about $69 million he's committed in this offseason with the Miller acquisition. That's $21 million left on his contract. The Myers deal is $30 million. The Benn deal is $4. The Ferland deal is $14. That's a lot of dough for a group that hasn't really had to pay their young studs yet. And when you look at Pettersson, when you look at Besser with, you know, the hype that Quinn Hughes has arrived with, you hope if he's anywhere near the hype that you have to pay him a lot of money because he's that good. The most dangerous spot, I believe, in the NHL is to be capped out and bad. And a worst case scenario for the Canucks in the near term is that.
Well, absolutely. And then, you know, look, they still have to figure out how to get themselves, you know, out from the Louis Erickson contract. I mean, that's still something that's lingering in Vancouver. So, you know, there's more work to be done, no question about it. I understand, you know, why there's optimism in Vancouver because, you know, yeah, when you look at the other parts of this lineup, and there are some really good pieces there. But I'm just not so sure, you know, what Myers and Ferlin at the end of the day, how much better they're going to make this team. I think at times, you know, they're going to show some flashes that they'll get Canucks fans excited and say, hey, great signing. I just think at the end of the day, in the long term, I just don't think that these are really good moves by Jim Benning. But, you know, maybe right now he does have to overpay.
I think there's two things. They're not good, so you are going to have to give more term and more money to get the guys. And secondly, the owner is hell-bent on being a playoff team next year. And if you're the GM, you've promised competitive rosters from day one, and you're in year five, and you fluked in on somebody else's roster early in your tenure. This is you got two guys that have been promising competitive hockey teams for 5 years, and it hasn't really translated, so chips are in there.
Well, they are, and there's no question that there's pressure from the owner to win. I mean, he, you know, this is a guy that is tired of you know, having fans masquerade as seats. And there was even a lot of, you know, there's been talk that he's been wanting to sell this team. So, hey, look, you know, with Pettersson, Besser, Horvat, Markstrom, and Nett, they're like I said, there are good pieces. It'll be interesting to see, you know, look, Tyler Myers, while the Winnipeg Jets are weaker, you know, God, they've lost half their D, mm-hmm. and they would love to have kept Tyler Myers. Definitely not at the price, though, that the Vancouver Canucks were offering.
Yeah, fair enough. Hey, how about San Jose? I really thought that Timo Meier deal, given how he popped this season, was a steal for Doug Wilson, albeit not significant in term. And then secondly, Kevin LeBanc. I mean, my goodness, this is quite the favor. It reminds me of what was going on in Boston when Torrey Krug's contract was up and they were capped out. And I think Riley Smith had the same situation. I mean, these are very team-friendly deals with, I suppose, from the player's perspective, the opportunity to hit it big on your next contract.
Well, I think that when, you know, when you look closely at the Timo Meier contract, while it does average out at $6 million a year, the key is the final year when his salary is at $10 million. So that if he gets tendered a qualifying offer, they've got to offer him, you know, at minimum $11 million. So that's where the Meier thing becomes, you know, in favor of the player, and a very smart, you know, deal at the end of the day, mm-hmm. the way that contract was constructed by his agent. So, yeah, on the surface, it is $6 million a year, but I think that he's really pointing to the fourth year of that deal and then that next contract, as you point out. In the Kevin LeBanc case, you know, look, this is a guy that's, you know, betting on himself. And, you know, we saw it in Philadelphia with Travis Sanheim. And I think that what Kevin LeBanc is looking at is, you know, if there was a two-year offer coming from the San Jose Sharks, maybe it would have been at, let's say, $1.75 million a year. And maybe it gets to $2 million. And I guess his feeling is that, hey, look, if I continue to exceed the numbers that I had this past season, well, I'm going to make up for it and then some in my next contract. So, you know, look, I applaud guys that have the confidence in their ability, and you know, if they can do it, then they're going to really they'll benefit. And you know, we will look back at this contract and say, hey, smart move.
Yeah, they have basically about the same amount of cap space as the Canucks. How crazy is that? Good work done from Doug Wilson. Do you expect both Marleau and Thornton back? I know we've all talked about it as if it's done, but you know, we would expect it later in the summer if it does happen. Is there an appetite from both the team and the two players on these two fronts?
Well, I definitely expect Joe Thornton back. I don't think there's any question that they'll find a way to make that happen. You know, it'll be interesting to see. I think a lot depends upon what type of dollars that they're able to work out in a Joe Thornton deal, and if that allows them, you know, still enough money to sign someone that may be able to give them more upside than what Patrick Marleau can. And while the Marleau story would be great and it'd be a nice storybook ending to his career, you know, I get the sense that the fact that he's not signed right now still tells me that Doug Wilson is trying to work out, you know, some other options. And I guess first and foremost, it's got to be the Joe Thornton contract to figure out what he has still left to work with. But, you know, it's going to be an interesting season in San Jose. I mean, Ryan, I look at this Sharks team, regardless of whether Thornton returns or not, or, well, I mean, he will return, but even with Joe Thornton coming back, I don't think that the team that's going to start the season next year for the Sharks is better than the team that finished it last season. I think that, you know, they're really counting on guys to have much better seasons. They're going to need Kevin LeBanc to pick up the offense, and they're going to need more from Timo Meier, because you've got to replace, one, the 38 goals from Joe Pavelski, but you still have to replace the 17 goals from Jonas Donskoy. And while he struggled in the second half of the season, that's still 17 goals that you're going to have to find. So I'm interested to see, you know, what the Sharks are able to do. I mean, obviously, you know, the Erik Karlsson signing may, you know, force two guys to be expendable in Pavelski and Justin Braun. Mm-hmm. Doug Wilson feels that they're, you know, they're a cup contender with Erik Karlsson and not one without him.
Yeah, and I don't think it's a huge indictment of the club to say that they're basically the same team or a smidge less than the one that lost the Blues, because if they're healthy against the Blues, they might beat the Blues. They did not look overmatched until, you know, half the roster was hobbling or Karlsson wasn't even playing. And I'll say this, an Erik Karlsson at age 29, I mean, when's his birthday? See, he just turned 29. 29-year-old Erik Karlsson, yep. If he wants to return close to Norris form, I think the Sharks are a phenomenal team in the West.
Well, there's two things you also have to look at with the Sharks. You've got Erik Karlsson returning from surgery. You've got Radim Simic, who's returning from surgery, ACL and MCL surgery. So you've got two-thirds of your D that are not they're not training this offseason. They're rehabbing this offseason. And it's going to take them time, I would think, to start the season and get themselves in game shape. I mean, it's tough coming back from those types of injuries. And a guy like Erik Karlsson, who at least reportedly has been never one that spends a lot of time in the offseason training, there's no question that he is going to have to spend a lot of time once he gets finished rehabbing, then to train. So it's going to be it'll be interesting. But that's two major injuries on their back end coming into the season.
Yeah, and of course the departure of Pavelski, their captain as well. Interesting stuff there. Let's switch teams in the Pacific, head over to the Vegas Golden Knights. I am absolutely fascinated what happens to Nikita Gusev, because if he were a free agent and anyone could have this guy, I think there'd be a ton of teams falling over themselves to get at him. He has outproduced Artemi Panarin's final years in the KHL. He's the same age, the same stature as Panarin. Panarin seems to be the comparable. People have watched him in Russia in terms of the style of play. I mean, it's not a stretch to suggest he could be a very impactful top six forward and maybe even a top line player in this league. And yet Vegas is capped out. He's never played a single game in this league, and he can always go back to the K to make $3-4 million. So he's not going to go play for $1 million somewhere. I don't know how this unfolds.
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely one where George McPhee has, he's overplayed his hand, and, He's definitely in a bind. And the thing is that even if they can't, you know, sign him right now and he decides to go back to the KHL, I mean, I look at their salary structure, and I'm not sure when they could bring this guy in without moving a significant part. And that was still the belief that the Golden Knights would have to move someone out of their top six. So it's going to be interesting, because even if they're able to trade Nikita Gusev, remember, they can't bring back any salary. They've got to trade prospects for him.
Yeah.
And that makes this deal even tougher, I believe, for George McPhee, because how do you quantify what this guy's worth draft pick-wise? Now, if I am a GM, you know, I would definitely try to see if I could part with a couple of second-round draft picks for Gusev, because, you know, really, George has got to, you know, he's really up against it.
Yeah, and if you're the Vegas Golden Knights, the other frustrating part is, what do second-round picks mean to you? You've had a billion of them. You got two next year. You got two the year after. I mean, it's not like they need these picks because they don't have any. They got tons of second-round picks. They're a group that feels like now's their window. So if you're going to move an impact player, you want someone that can help you win, and a second-round pick ain't doing that. A second-round pick, you don't know if that's a player or a ham sandwich until like four or five years later.
Absolutely, Ryan. I had, you know, one GM tell me that really, at the end of the day, you know, second-round draft picks, trading for them or acquiring them, really, you know, they may sound okay, but really, as you put it, a lot of times that can be a ham sandwich.
Okay, other notes from around the Pacific Division. What do the Coyotes look like? We liked their blue line last year in terms of its depth when it was healthy. They couldn't get healthy in net, but that allowed them to find a higher level in Darcy Kemper's play. And they finally got some offense in Phil Kessel. That was the one area they just absolutely could not score last year.
Yeah, I mean, look, he would be their leading goal scorer, at least for the past two seasons. I didn't go back three seasons, but, you know, 28 goals last season for Phil, and that was somewhat of an off year for him. The expectation is that he'll play with Nick Schmaltz. And look, people may remember Schmaltz and Patrick Kane were a pretty good duo in Chicago. Schmaltz has the ability to play with a high-end guy. So I know Rick Tocchet has alluded to the fact that he would expect right now those two guys are penciled in playing together. And the Coyotes, who are so starved for being able to score goals, this is a great fit for them. And then for Kessel to be reunited with Rick Tocchet, someone that he had such a great relationship with in Pittsburgh. I think this is a really good deal for the Coyotes. They need him. And for Phil, you know, he gets himself out of the limelight. And I think, you know, it's a good landing spot. No question for Phil. And although, Ryan, I'm still wondering. I did look today, but I couldn't find it. I know Phil was at the World Series of Poker in the main event. And he was around in day three. Don't know if he survived day three and made it into day four.
Phil Ivey? Phil Kessel. Okay, sure. I'm going to look up the main event, Phil Kessel. I'm going to Google that while you tell me something about the Kings. It sounds like they're ready to offload veterans, but there's not a lot of buyers right now.
Well, the thought was that you know, around the trade deadline, you go back to the trade deadline, and you know, we felt that whether it was Jeff Carter or Tyler Toffoli or Jonathan Quick, you know, one of those guys, if not more than one of those guys, was going to get moved, if not at the deadline, you know, somewhere in and around the draft. And all three of those guys are still on the LA Kings roster. Now, Tyler Toffoli's got a year left on his deal. And I think, you know, look, the Kings would love, you know, they don't want to give up on this guy because he does have the ability to score goals. And they're a team that is struggling to score. And they're hoping that he can finally break through and have, you know, have the year like he did, you know, like two seasons ago. But so I don't think they're going to move him right now. They were looking for a first round draft pick at the deadline. They didn't get that for Toffoli. In the case of Quick and Jeff Carter, you know, I still think that the LA Kings are going to try to move Jack Campbell. I may be in the minority on that, but you know, I keep bringing up the fact that he's got 1 year left on his deal before he becomes a UFA. And with the expansion draft, you know, coming up in a couple of years, they're going to, you know, they could easily lose a goalie. And why not lose Jonathan Quick if you feel that Cal Peterson is your goalie of the future? In Jeff Carter's case, you know, he's got 3 years left and his cap hits around five, but he's only actually owed $7 million in actual salary over the next 3 years. They would like to move him. I mean, there's no question that the Kings, you know, pretty much these next two seasons, and definitely this season for sure, is just another season to try to, you know, rebuild. Hopefully for their sake, they don't make the playoffs and they can get themselves into the lottery again. But I think it's somewhat disappointing that they haven't been able to move either one of, you know, Carter or Quick. And that just kind of tells you, I think in some regards, just, you know, in Quick's case, maybe the health is a question. And I know he's owed $7 million in salary this year, and then it drops significantly the next three. But I think that's it's been a little disappointing from that standpoint for the LA Kings.
Why didn't it work with Patrick Marleau there? Essentially, Carolina spent like around $4 million and got a first rounder. That sounds like something Rob Blake should have been in the market for.
Well, I think that when you look at the deals, you know, the Kings, what, they had two first round draft picks this year. They've got all their draft picks the following year. And I think that I don't think there was really the appetite to spend, you know, although I guess what, you know, $6 million is worth a first round draft pick.
Well, it wasn't even six though, because it was back end loaded or front end loaded. So it was only, I think it was only about $4 million to buy him out. And, you know, the AAV was higher, but it's not the actual money owed. It just felt like for Carolina, how do you not do that with your team with space? A free first round pick, albeit one you'd assume to come in sort of 25 to 31. But that's the type of move LA should be making right now. They need all the lottery tickets they can get.
True. I can't give you a definitive answer. And maybe they just felt that, you know, where that draft pick would have fallen, albeit it was still a first round draft pick, that, they just had better, you know, more fish to fry. And but I really can't give you a definitive answer why they couldn't have been the training partner instead of Arizona.
Anything else from around the division that has caught your eye or that's a hot spot worth watching? I know Edmonton wanted to make a big splash. Their offseason remains very quiet.
Well, I think it's just got to be frustrating for Connor. I mean, you know, to see what hasn't happened in Edmonton, you know, and I think that, you know, the very fact that they felt that, you know, they had to go out and spend, you know, $2 million a year for 2 years for Alex Chiasson, that's a bit of a head scratcher to me. I know that, you know, he was a good fit in that room, but there's another guy that, you know, came off that PTO last year, played for under $1 million, had a great first half, and then, you know, was pretty much on a milk cart in the second half. I just don't really understand that. And still, even the Mike Smith deal, I get, you know, I guess they're buying time. And maybe they couldn't find a way to entice Curtis McElhaney, but I'm still not sure if I know what's going on in Edmonton.
Thanks for the chat. Enjoy your summer, will you?
I will do my best. I'm heading to Quebec and Montreal next week.
Okay, buddy. Enjoy that, and we'll check in down the road.
All right, man. Take care. Enjoy the Stampede. You know, just be careful, Ryan.
Just mix in a few waters, huh?